First, it's the Week in Washington, where we look at some of the week's top stories in national political news. We're going to focus on results we know to this point for national congressional races in the general election that ended yesterday. And just a reminder that votes are still being counted in a number of states. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What are your first reactions to what happened in the U.S. House of Representatives and the Senate? Is it what you expected, or were you surprised? What questions do you have about the changing composition of the next Congress? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. David Cannon is a professor of political science at UW-Madison, where he focuses on Congress, elections, and race and politics. David, welcome back to Central Time.
Good to be with you.
Well, how are you doing, David, after a long night of election watching, I assume?
it was definitely a short night of sleep, but lots of interesting results to talk about, for sure.
Before we turn to Congress, I want to get your read on the presidential election. Wisconsin projected to go toward Biden by the AP, still a likely recount, still the canvassing to happen. Where are your eyes now on the presidential race?
Well, it looks like Michigan also is now going to go to Biden. It hasn't been called yet, but the margin there is now up to 61,000 votes with 99% counted. So it looks like Michigan is going to be called probably by the end of the day for Biden. So it's really coming down to Nevada and Pennsylvania and Georgia, or the remaining states. And Biden needs to win just one of those three to put him over the top. In fact, if he wins Nevada, it would make it the narrowest win in the Electoral College ever at 270 to 268, two electoral vote margin if Biden carries Nevada and loses Pennsylvania and Georgia.
Now we're hearing some hullabaloo in Pennsylvania and Michigan, protests calling for stopping the vote count, the president suing in both those states. We're going to talk more about this in other conversations of the show. Do you think we're going to settle in for a protracted legal dispute here?
Well, yeah, sounds like the president will be taking this to court, but it seems pretty clear that they are going to count all the votes. The question in Pennsylvania would be if they would try to revisit that 4-4 decision from the U.S. Supreme Court a couple weeks ago when John Roberts voted with the three liberals to uphold the state Supreme Court ruling saying that Pennsylvania could have the extra time to count those votes that came in postmarked by Election Day but came in after Election Day. And that's what would be at question in that appeal. Would they bring that up again? And it's not clear to me that the verdict would be any different, especially given that the voters who did vote in the last week to 10 days of the election did so with the assumption that their vote would count. And the Supreme Court has never changed the rules of the game after the fact in a situation like that under something that's called the Purcell principle, that you don't change rules, voting rules, even before the election, if it's a short period of time before the election. So I can't imagine them changing that ruling.
All right. We mainly called you, David, to turn toward Congress. And it looks like big picture here, Democrats had hopes of coming into this, expanding their House majority and thinking they had a shot at taking a majority in the Senate. And it seems like they are not getting that, breaking their way. What are you seeing?
Yeah, definitely a big night for the Republicans, big day for the Republicans in Congress. That right now, the Republicans have a net gain of 5 in the House, where that's sort of ballpark what most people were guessing the Democrats would do is pick up 5. Now, we still have 43 races that haven't been called there. But if you look at the remaining races, it looks like the Republicans really are doing incredibly well in what the states that were called toss-up states. They're pretty much sweeping those toss-up states. The Democrats are leading right now in just 3 of those remaining races that were rated as toss-ups, where Republicans already having won about a dozen of those and then leading in another about 8 or 9. And so the Republicans really had a very good day in the House races. And same thing in the Senate, where like 538, some of the other forecasters gave the Democrats about a 75% chance of picking up the Senate, usually saying it'd be like 51 seats. So it was going to be close, but the forecasters were thinking the Democrats could pick up the Senate. Right now, it looks like, well, it's 47 to 48 at this point, with Michigan, North Carolina, and the two Georgia seats still in balance, and Alaska as well hasn't been called, but that's definitely Republican. It looks like that North Carolina seat's going to go Republican. It looks like Democrats hang on to Michigan. That was a very tight race, but as these mail-in ballots are being counted now, a lot of them are coming in from Detroit. And just in the last hour, Gary Peters, the incumbent there, the Democratic incumbent, has gone ahead narrowly, and I mean really narrowly, 10,000 votes out of 5.2 million votes cast. This is a super close election in the Senate race there. But since I talked to your producer about an hour and a half ago, Maine was called for Susan Collins. So Susan Collins squeaked in with just over 50% because in Maine, you know, they have the ranked choice voting. And so had Susan Collins been under 50%, then the votes of the minor party candidates come into play with voters getting to register their second preference then. And most of the polling showed that Sarah Gideon, the Democrat, would have won most of those votes from the minor party candidates. So there was a chance that if Collins would have ended up with, say, 49% of the vote, Gideon could have potentially caught her in the ranked choice voting allocation of the votes. But that didn't happen. Collins hung on to that seat. So now it's really down to just those Georgia races. We've got one of them already in the runoff. That's the race with Warnock against Kelly Loeffler. And that'll be on January 5th. And then the other race right now, David Perdue is leading Ossoff, but it's pretty close to 50%. So Perdue is at 50.6 right now. If he falls below 50%, then we'll have another runoff in January as well, with the balance of the Senate then being up for grabs. It would be, you know, 50 to 48 at that point in all likelihood. The Democrats would need to win both of those Georgia races to get to 50-50. And then Vice President Harris, assuming that, you know, Biden hangs on in Nevada, Vice President Harris would break the tie in the Senate. So it would be a really pretty wild scenario to get us to that situation. But it could happen, but it's very much a long shot at this point.
Talking to David Cannon, political scientist at UW-Madison, looking at congressional results around the country. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions and reactions. Francis joins us now in Rice Lake. Francis, hi. Francis, are you there?
Yes.
Yeah, what did you want to tell us about, Francis?
Say it again?
Talk now, Francis. What did you want to say?
Wow. Number one is wow. Wisconsin needs to lead the nation instead of follow the nation. Wow. I just heard that Wisconsin finally has turned against this narcissistic president, human being. Well, I'm bragging them up when I say human being. What else do you want me to say? Am I on air?
Francis, thanks for calling in. David, Francis, happy about the Wisconsin outcome. You know, Donald Trump won in 2016 by about 20,000 votes by the current unofficial count. Joe Biden wins by 20,000 if that holds up. I don't know. We're really on the wire here in Wisconsin, either way you slice it, David.
Yeah, no, it really was interesting looking at the Wisconsin results to see it as really pretty much exactly what happened in 2016, with just slight movement towards Biden in enough counties to make up for that 20,000 vote difference. And so, but what happened really is that most of the Trump counties in 2016 stayed Trump counties, and most of the Clinton counties stayed for Joe Biden, and there was very little movement across counties. So when you compare 2012 to 2016, there were 22, 23 counties that flipped from Obama to Trump. In this election yesterday, there were only two counties, Sauk and Door County, were the only two in the state that flipped from Trump to Biden, and none of them went the other way. And so if anything, the districts actually got more polarized, that the Trump counties even went more strongly for Trump, and the Clinton counties went more strongly for Joe Biden.
Let's stay in Wisconsin now. Most of our congressional races were pretty much a slam dunk for the incumbent or the incumbent party in one case following a retirement. The one close race was the one held by incumbent Democrat Ron Kind in western Wisconsin. Looks like I think that has been declared now. Looks like he has hung on, but it was close, right?
Yeah, it was the closest race that he'd had since 2010. If you go back and look at his electoral margins over his career, he was first elected in 1996. That initial race was very close to 52-48. But then for almost every election after that, he was winning with 60, 65% of the vote. Then 2010, he had a tight race where he won by 3.5%. That was that huge Republican landslide in 2010, Barack Obama's first midterm. Republicans did really well nationally. And so Kind barely hung on in that election. But this was his closest race ever at a 3% margin. And so, yeah, that was unexpectedly close in that district that normally is a pretty safe district for Ron Kind.
We are talking to UW-Madison professor of political science, David Cannon, looking at the results of the election for Congress.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. How polarized are things where you live? Is your county all red, all blue, split down the middle? Let's talk about it at 800-642-1234, or you can tweet us at Central Time WPR.
We'll continue the conversation coming up next on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Keeley Boltina. Right now, we're talking with David Cannon. He's a professor of political science at UW-Madison. It's the week in Washington, and we're looking at congressional results from the general election.
You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, reactions, recriminations. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on another caller now. Scott is with us in Menominee. Scott, hi.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. What do you want to bring up?
Well, I was going to see if you had any, maybe some observations on some of the data that you might have seen so far, that if gerrymandering in any of the districts that may have happened, if anything stands out, number-wise to you.
Yeah, it's a good question on gerrymandering. This is the last election in the 10-year cycle before we redraw the lines next time around. And one thing I think that we've seen in a lot of states, including Wisconsin, is that gerrymandering often makes it so districts aren't as competitive, that they are basically incumbency protection plans that, create safe districts for incumbents. And in Wisconsin, that's, pretty much been the case now in this last decade, is that we have 8 congressional districts here. And none of them have really been very competitive for some time. That's why I was really kind of surprised to see Ron Kind having a tough challenge, because he usually wins with 60, 65% of the vote. But we see that all across the country, that if you, look at the races that, in a lot of states, there'd only be a handful of competitive races. Now, there are actually still quite a few that haven't been decided, but that's more because the votes just haven't been counted yet. Like New York is notorious for taking forever to count votes, and they still have about 5 or 6 races there that haven't been called. There are a handful of other races in that part of the country too. And so a lot of it, I think once the votes come in, they'll be fairly secure victories for the incumbents. And so, Scott's exactly right that, gerrymandering has around the country created less competitive districts than you would have if the districts were more fairly drawn by a nonpartisan process.
Thanks, Scott, for calling in at 800-642-1234. Susie joins us next in Westfield. Susie, hi.
Hi, good afternoon. I am just struck by the geographic map of the country, red versus blue. And I think it is showing us in very simple terms, perhaps the greatest foundational division in America at this point in time. And it's regional, and it's lifestyle, and it's rural versus urban. I know that I've been a small town girl all my life and I have farming family roots and workaday folk roots and so forth. I'm a professional person myself. But I will tell you that people here in my area, every rural area that I'm familiar with and that I pass through on a day-to-day basis, does not feel that the Democratic Party is in touch with them with us, with our lifestyle, with what our lives are like. There's a disrespect for our simple lifestyle that maybe we're not hip and happening enough. When you look at the national map and you see such a large red geographic block, it's striking, and I'm concerned because life is different in rural and small town America, and our economies are different. And I just feel, well, I am sure that folks in my neighborhood and in rural America in general do not feel that the Democratic Party understands us or what it takes to keep us going.
Susie, thanks a lot for calling in. And David, I know that's a heavy subject of research for one of your colleagues, Kathy Kramer at UW-Madison, that divide between urban and rural communities in Wisconsin and elsewhere.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, so Kathy Kramer has written about this subject in a book that she published about Wisconsin politics on exactly what Susie's talking about. And she calls this the politics of resentment. And this is what Professor Kramer found when she traveled around the state of Wisconsin and talked to people. She would go to like the small coffee shop where people would hang out and talk politics and Packer football and whatever else. And she just would sit and listen to them and talk. And this came up time and time again, exactly what Susie was talking about, of the lack of understanding, the lack of respect, feeling like they're being taken for granted, feeling like the urban areas are getting all the benefits and the rural areas don't get their share of the of support from the state. And if you look at the map, it is striking. I mean, especially in the Plains states and the upper Midwest, most of the rural areas are red. I mean, there's exceptions. There are, you know, a couple of congressional districts in Wisconsin and Minnesota, Iowa, a couple in Colorado, you know, scattered around. There are a few rural Democratic districts, but it's heavily Republican for sure in the rural parts of the upper Midwest and the Plains states. Now, if you head south, it's a little bit different. So in the south, both in Mississippi, Alabama, Georgia, South Carolina, North Carolina, Florida, and into Texas as well, you see quite a few rural Democratic counties. And there it often has to do with the percent non-white voters, African-American, in the South, and then the Latino vote in Texas being critical there. But overall, this urban-rural divide is real. It is something that is one of the central divides in American politics today. And I think it's something that both Democrats and Republicans need to pay more attention to. Like, what can Democrats do to appeal more to rural voters? What can Republicans do to appeal more to urban voters? And so, yeah, this is an important topic.
Susie, thanks a lot for calling in. We're talking to David Cannon from UW-Madison, looking at the congressional elections this year, some still being counted. Back to your calls now. Greg is with us in Waukesha. Greg, hi.
Hi. My question is, what does Dr. Cannon think will be the impact of the election on the makeup of major congressional committees, both in the House and the Senate? And do you think that there will be enough residual animosity that we're going to be in gridlock, or could there actually be some bipartisan efforts? That's the first part of the question. The second one is, if this level of animosity is going to prevent the Republican Party from even moving inchwise to its past, which isn't what it is today. Thank you.
Greg, thanks for calling. A lot to work with there. David, first of all, prospects for gridlock in what seems like a likely outcome, Democrats holding the House, Republicans holding the Senate, and possibly a Democratic president, asterisk, we don't know that yet.
Right. And so, yeah, certainly the formula is there for continued gridlock. Still have Nancy Pelosi as Speaker of the House, you still have Mitch McConnell as Majority Leader of the Senate. You know, the change in the equation, though, looks like, again, we don't know for sure this is going to happen, but we're leaning in that direction of having Joe Biden as president. And certainly Joe Biden has campaigned on the theme of bringing the country together, of healing our divide. And so he clearly has signaled that he's much more interested in trying to work across the partisan aisle and try to work on bipartisan kinds of policies. And so I think you will see that effort, that outreach from the White House to do that. Now, whether or not Mitch McConnell and the Senate Republicans are open to those overtures or not, we'll have to see. They certainly didn't with Barack Obama, who also tried initially to do that with the Senate, and they basically shut him down and said, we want to make Barack Obama a one-term president. And so we'll have to see how that goes. I must say, given the last 4 years or even more, the partisan divide does seem to be getting deeper and deeper, and it'll be tough for Joe Biden to try to overcome that on his own.
Do you see maybe consequences for Democratic leaders in Congress? I know this happens every time there's a downward slide, but there have been rumblings. Are Democrats in the House going to try to replace Nancy Pelosi as House Speaker? Do you envision anything like that happening?
I would have a hard time seeing that happening unless, it ends up being, the Democrats barely hanging on and they end up, losing, quite a few more seats. Then it's possible there could be a revolt against Pelosi. But I think overall she has been seen by, Democratic partisans as being a very effective speaker. And so I would be surprised if there was any serious effort to have a internal revolt.
I know it's probably too soon to try to learn lessons from this election, and they always change the next time anyway. But David, what do you look for in the future now from what we've learned so far?
Well, the one thing I think, two things I'm looking to. One is this question of polarization and bipartisanship. I mean, is Biden's a pledge, if indeed he becomes our president, is his pledge to try to bring the country together, is that going to be possible? Because I know there are a lot of Americans out there who are hungry for that. Like, they are tired of the division. They want to try to bring the country together. And so we'll have to see how that plays out. And the second thing that was, I think, a bit of a surprise from the election last night was how much President Trump was able to appeal to voters of color. It was somewhat more success both among Latinos and a little bit more among Black voters than he had in 2016. So is that a signal?
We'll leave it there. Thanks to David Cannon, professor of political science at UW-Madison.